Going to switch gears. There's been a lot of talk about drought and heat stresses today, so now we're going to talk a little bit about cold, which I'm sure no one really wants to think about. I'm Michelle DaCosta from University of Massachusetts. The research I'll be presenting on today was actually conducted by my graduate student, Lindsay Hoffman, as part of her dissertation research, where we're looking at differences in freezing tolerance among accessions of Lolium perenni, or perennial ryegrass. So I work in turf, and so I know there's been some other presentations here. So just to give you a little bit of background on perennial ryegrass, it's actually one of the most widely utilized cool season grasses as for turf purposes as well as forage. And the reason why it's very amenable for turf purposes is because it has fairly rapid germination and establishment rates, and also performs very well under traffic tolerance, which again, which would be good for things like athletic fields, home lawns, golf courses, and things like that. However, some of the weaknesses of perennial ryegrass is that it does tend to be more sensitive to certain temperature extremes and as well as drought stress. And one of the major things that we work with in Massachusetts is looking at the sensitivity of ryegrass to winter kill. Unfortunately, we really haven't had a majority of the breeding focus on perennial ryegrass has been towards either disease resistance or some to improve heat and drought tolerance. And so this is one of the things that we're trying to look at. So this picture is from University of Minnesota, turf grass breeder there, Eric Watkins. And so one of his major focuses is trying to improve the freezing tolerance or winter hardiness of perennial ryegrass. And this study was published a couple years ago in 2007, where they actually evaluated 300 public accessions of perennial ryegrass. And you can see from this picture, this was after one of their winters. And they showed pretty good differences in winter hardiness among some of the accessions, and some of them showed very good winter hardiness. So as a result of this work, we started to collaborate, and the primary objectives of what I'll be reporting on today is we wanted to really understand, look at some of these accessions and try to understand the physiological basis for the differences in freezing tolerance. Some information on the accessions, we chose to assess four different accessions, and throughout the study, these are how we'll be abbreviating them. The two tolerant accessions, tolerant 1 and tolerant 2, this is just to show you, this is the research that was conducted again by Hulke et al. In Minnesota. This is a fairly cold-tolerant turf grass variety. It doesn't have very good turf-type characteristics, but it does have good winter hardiness. And so then we also had two susceptible accessions, again, that were chosen from the study. And as you can see, the field survival ratings were either better than or equal to our winter hardy check or very poor compared to that. As a follow-up to this field study, they also looked at controlled freeze tests. And so winter hardiness is a complex trait and can be affected by many different things, such as overall freezing tolerance, but things like anoxia or crown hydration potential, or even susceptibility to different winter diseases, such as the snow mold. And so with this study here, doing the controlled freeze tests, they wanted to determine the LT50. For those of you who aren't familiar with a lot of the low temperature research, LT50 stands for the lethal temperature for 50% kill. And so we use that. It's a temperature that we use to kind of try to assess differences in treatments or our genotype in freezing tolerance. And so what they found, based on controlled freeze tests, that they actually saw a very good correlation between what they saw in the field. And so based on this, we then went with the hypothesis. We really wanted to understand, back to our objective slide, whether one of the factors that could affect freezing tolerance has to do with the cold acclimation period and whether during that time different genotypes might have differences in the ability to accumulate certain protective compounds at low temperatures. And so the factors that I'll be talking about today will be, we looked at crown carbohydrate content and lipid changes. And so So we grew the four accessions, and we established them from single seeds in 10 by 10 centimeter pots. They were maintained in a greenhouse for approximately 3 months because we wanted to get them nice and established before going into freeze tests. And they were watered and fertilized weekly. They were subsequently moved into a growth chamber where we then subjected the plants to cold acclimation. And so our cold acclimation is going to be similar to the previous study that was published by Hulke et al. So we can kind of replicate what they saw with their freezing tolerance. And so we exposed the plants to a constant 2 degrees Celsius, which is known to induce cold acclimation in perennial ryegrass. And we did this for 21 days. And they were maintained under optimal cold acclimating conditions, so a long photoperiod as well as adequate light levels under the acclimation process, because again, we wanted to try to make sure that we could assess the genotypic differences. So we conducted measurements weekly during the cold acclimation period, so 0, 7, 14, and 21 days. And one of the non-destructive measurements that we looked at was canopy photochemical efficiency, or FE over FM. The reason we did this, we didn't really know very much about these accessions, and because the cold acclimation process is very energy requiring in terms of relating back to photosynthesis and the energy that goes into accumulating things like carbohydrates, we wanted to see if there could be a potential difference in photoinhibition that was occurring under cold acclimation. So that was why we did that. We also focus on sampling of the crown tissue. So if you see other studies that might focus on the leaves, the crowns are actually the survival organs of grasses. And so we really wanted to correlate what was happening at the crown level with what we saw with changes in freezing tolerance. So with the crowns, we had to destructively sample that and remove the leaf and stem tissue, so down to the crown level, and also we removed most of the roots as well. So carbohydrate content, they were extracted from dry tissues, and they were quantified using HPLC. And for lipids, we actually extracted the lipid content at UMass, but then we sent down the evaporated samples to the Kansas State Lipidomics Center, because we weren't just looking at the fatty acid analysis. We also wanted to look at changes in the major lipid, phospholipid species in the membranes. And so for that, that was used at Kansas State using electrospray ionization and tandem mass spectrometry. So here we use a randomized complete block design with four replicates, and so we separated our means using Fisher's LSD. So because of the time constraints, what I'll be doing is I figured it would be fine to just present what happened at 0 days or non-acclimated conditions compared to 21 days of acclimation. And so first, the look at photochemical efficiency. Again, here we have 0 versus 21 days on the x-axis, and then the two susceptible cultivars are next to each other on the left, followed by the two tolerant cultivars. And so what we see overall with photochemical efficiency is that there is a significant decline in photochemical efficiency, which is to be expected and is similar to what other people have found under cold acclimation. It is an acclimation of photosynthesis to low temperatures. However, and again, these are LSD bars, not standard error bars, and so there were no significant differences among the four accessions. So this kind of leads us to believe that, at least based on photochemical efficiency, that there don't seem to be differences with one accession maybe having or exhibiting higher photoinhibition or something under acclimation. When we looked at our carbohydrate content, we found that sucrose constituted the major fraction of carbohydrates of what we analyzed. And so, again, overall, we saw that there was a pretty large increase in sucrose content in response to 2 degrees Celsius acclimation. And the one thing that was kind of interesting is that the tolerant accession, tolerant one, actually had higher pre-stress or pre-acclimation levels of certain carbohydrates, and sucrose was one of them, whereas one of the susceptible genotypes also had less, but we don't know exactly what the significance, if that's of any significance. When we go to 21 days of acclimation, both tolerant accessions actually were able to accumulate higher amounts of sucrose content. We also saw similar results for the reducing sugars, which were in this fraction made up of glucose and fructose. Here we see the general decline here in these simple sugars, but again, by the end of 21 days acclimation, we're still seeing that the two tolerant accessions are maintaining higher sugar content, reducing sugar content. One of the other fractions of sugars we also looked at, because they've been reported to play a role in freezing tolerance, are the raffinose family oligosaccharides. So this graph here sums raffinose and stachyose. Again, an overall increase in the RFOs, or raffinose family oligosaccharides, but we didn't really see any difference among the accessions. So really, among the different carbohydrate fractions that we looked at, sucrose tended to be the one that most widely separated the four accessions. And I'll talk about this later, but we did not measure fructans, which are the major storage carbohydrates and play a very important role in freezing tolerance, and that's something that we're going to be looking at next, but we did not do that in this study, and I think that it will probably play an even more important role than what we've seen here. A little bit of background on lipid, phospholipid species, if you're not familiar with that. So membranes, phospholipids, are actually composed of many different species or classes, and so, and I've abbreviated them here, such as PC, PE, PA, and so on. And so, and you also have the galactolipids, just like that compose a lot of your thylakoid membranes, so things like MGDG and DGDG. And so I'm gonna primarily report on the phospholipids. And the reason that there's different classes of these is that they actually take on slightly different shapes in the membranes. And so, and because of that, some phospholipid groupings can be considered to be more highly membrane stabilizing, where others can be more destabilizing, especially at low temperature. And so what we found in our study, again, we were analyzing changes at the crown level. We actually found that the majority of our phospholipids came down into these three major categories, the PC, PA, and PE. And so when you look at the classification of these lipids, PC tends to be more lipid, or they consider it more of a membrane stabilizing lipid group, whereas these two, PA and PE, are actually associated with destabilizing the membrane at low temperature. So you want to see that you don't have very high levels of that. And so what we found, these letters here are separating, again, the 2 days of acclimation, just to give you a general idea of what was happening. We saw a big increase in the levels of PC, which seemed to be pretty good, whereas we saw a large decrease in the percentage of PA among all the total lipids that were extracted. And so when we look at the ratio, because sometimes this is reported in the literature, and again, we see, again, an increase in our PC to our membrane stabilizing to membrane destabilizing lipid groups. And so when we looked at this ratio among the four different accessions, we see that we have a general trend, but there are not statistical differences, but the tolerant two seem to have the highest ratio of membrane stabilizing lipids, whereas our susceptible had the lowest. So this is kind of giving us an indication that lipids could be the changes in lipid composition. And so additionally, we looked at the double bond index, which gave us an idea of what the unsaturation levels are. So under cold stress, we want to see an increase in unsaturated fatty acids to help provide membrane fluidity at low temperatures, help maintain metabolic function at low temperatures. And so when we look at among the two groupings here, we see that the tolerant two accession maintained higher levels or higher double bond index, saying that there's higher levels of unsaturated fatty acids. And then we did look at the fatty acid composition, and just as we've seen in other many studies, we see that our major saturated fatty acids, so palmitic and stearic acid, there was a large decline in response to cold acclimation, which is good. And or in reverse, we see a large increase in our two more unsaturated fatty acids, so linoleic and linolenic acids, so a large increase in response to cold acclimation. And so we often see that sometimes freezing tolerance has been correlated with a higher ratio of the linolenic acid. And so we looked at that among the four accessions, and we saw a definite statistical difference between the tolerant two accession, which exhibited much higher levels of this ratio of 18:3 to 18:2. So when we put this together, we found that some of the intraspecific differences among the accessions could potentially be associated with different capacities to accumulate some of these compounds. And again, we found that our two tolerant accessions were able to accumulate higher levels of the soluble carbohydrates during cold acclimation. Additionally, we found that tolerant two accession had a higher capacity to modify its lipid composition, so either in terms of its total, the types of lipid species that were present in the membranes, as well as unsaturation levels. And so together, when we look at these changes, these are going to be really important to help stabilize cellular stability, either by stabilizing the membranes or other important parts of the cell, such as proteins. And so since we're seeing, I mean, in the end result, we're working with breeders to try to understand whether we can improve the efficiency, the screening criteria to improve different abiotic stress tolerances. And we see that it's obviously not just one trait that we're going for here, and it's multiple traits. And I wanted to just end and show that we also looked at some leaf modifications. We sampled the leaf tissue. And just at 21 days, you can also notice that we found a trend Statistical differences here where the tolerant accessions also had higher total leaf antioxidant capacity and leaf phenolic activity as well. So these are different things I think that are going to need to be looked at, but hopefully we can, these are just with four accessions, but we're hoping then to expand these and try to understand on a greater scale whether we can use some of this information to breed more efficiently. And so for future research, the one thing I did mention that we did not do in this study is what are the roles of fructans. Again, these are the major storage carbohydrates. And so we've seen in our other research that fructans are going to be very important. So we're interested to take a look at, among different accessions, whether we also see differences in the fructan accumulation. And then the last thing, we looked at a very small part of what may contribute to freezing tolerance. So we just looked at this part of cold acclimation. And I think it's worth to mention that there could be other factors that could be contributing to differences in the winter survival of these accessions. And so something like deacclimation potential, so do they differ in the winter or coming out of the spring with how easily they come out of this overall state of dormancy, which could affect its the freezing sensitivity. So with that, I would like to finish off by thanking a couple people, Dr. Peter Jaranyama from UMass for helping us with the HPLC work, and also Dr. Ruth Welty and Mary Roth at the Kansas State Lipidomic Center. This was a huge amount of information that was generated. It was our first time kind of working with this and trying to understand, and so we're just kind of at the tip of trying to understand what's going on with the lipids, and they were very helpful with that. And then some of our undergraduate research assistants, Zach and Mike. And with that, I'd like to thank you, and thank you for attending this afternoon's session. And if there's time, I will take questions. No? I think everyone wants to get out in the sun. Are there any questions for any of the other speakers here this afternoon? Okay. Thank you very much. Have a good, safe trip back.